Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to another video on ForgottenWeapons.com. I'm Ian McCollum, and today I want to relate to you a story of true crime and skullduggery and fraud in the gun collecting world, specifically relating to one R.L. Wilson, a noted cult scholar and author who's produced books like The Cult Heritage, Cult and American Legend. They're very pretty books with lots of really good pictures, and I will let Othias over at CN Arsenal get into more detail about why they're pretty much useless today. In fact, this is a story that Othias actually scooped me on. He put out a couple weeks ago, while I was prepping this video, a fantastic 2-hour-long podcast discussing the story and a lot more around it with Danny Michaels, who is the curator now of the Cody Firearms Museum. So I strongly recommend that if you find this interesting, go over to Patreon, subscribe to support CN Arsenal, because that is the only way that you can get access to their patrons-only podcast series, and then listen to the podcast with Danny and Othias talking about R.L. Wilson and all the events surrounding this. Now, Danny and Othias are scrupulous in sticking to exactly and only the known facts of the story, based on an investigation that was done by the Connecticut State Police. I'm going to fill in a few of the blanks. So what I'm going to tell you today is a little bit speculative. I cannot prove all of the allegations in here, but to my mind, they absolutely make sense, and they're the only way that the actions in this story do make sense. So I'm going to tell you what I believe is the true and full version of the events. If you want the scrupulous, only the facts, ma'am, just the facts, Danny and Othias cover that really well. Now, in addition, I have 500-plus pages of the original Connecticut State Police investigation report on this event that I am posting over on ForgottenWeapons.com as a PDF. So if, again, you want to know more about this, you are welcome to head over to that blog post, download the entire massive document, it's a couple hundred meg PDF, and read about this in all of its excruciating detail as it was investigated by the Connecticut State Police. Now, to set the framework here a little bit, the reason we're talking about the Connecticut State Police is that this story centers around the Connecticut State Library System, which, aside from being a library, also houses historical collections of things relevant to the history of the state of Connecticut. And in 1957, the Colt Company donated basically its entire firearms reference collection to the Connecticut State Library System. This was some 1,250-odd firearms at the time. They did this with a couple of caveats. One is that none of the guns could ever be sold, and guns in this donation could only be traded out of the library's collection if they were exact duplicates of guns the libraries already had and then done to improve the quality of the library collection. This is a little bit restrictive, but it's certainly understandable. Colt was giving these guns to the library to basically have them in public possession so that everyone could see and appreciate these important elements of Connecticut state history. They weren't donating them so the library could sell them. So, and to introduce our major player, R.L. Wilson. By the time that all of these events took place, which was in the late 1970s and early 1980s, R.L. Wilson, Larry Wilson, was a pillar of the collecting community, especially regarding Colts. Now, this is a period when the collecting community was focused on guns like Colts and Winchesters and Civil War firearms and some of the big-name, very respectable American gun companies. It is, of course, also a pre-internet time, and the way that the collecting community worked in those days was a little bit different than what we would recognize today, especially younger folks like me. There was no internet. You couldn't just go out and search for things for sale. At the highest levels of collecting, and we're talking six-figure-plus guns, $100,000 guns in the 1970s, the way this worked is you'd find a dealer. The dealer knew everybody who was a collector, and they knew where they could source guns, and there were a handful of people at the top of the community who were basically the brokers. And if you wanted something really high-end, you'd go to a broker. Auction houses weren't particularly interested in firearms. They did some business in guns, but not like we have today. And similarly, the communication between collectors directly was a little bit less, there were organizations of collectors, but in general, you're talking about a postal system and a small number of collector publications where people could advertise and cross-reference. In general, things worked through brokers, and R.L. Wilson was like the king of the brokers. He knew everybody, he knew where everything was, and if you wanted something, he was the guy to get it for you. Now, R.L. Wilson was well aware of the Colt collection at the Connecticut State Library. He was a frequent visitor to it from his very early days being interested in firearms. He became a well-recognized face there, and despite the fact that he was actually not the official Connecticut State consultant on firearms, that was Norm Flederman, who I want to point out as sort of a footnote here. As far as I have any way of knowing, Norm Flederman's honesty and integrity was impeccable. He was a brilliant man. A pivotal role in the collecting community and in firearms in general. And I hesitate to even include his name in this story because it gives that perception of guilt, which is absolutely not true in the case of Norm Flederman. What happened with the Connecticut State Library is that R.L. Wilson was the guy who was always showing up and poking through the guns and researching and trying to learn stuff and offering his services for free to the library. And he was the convenient guy to go to when they needed to get something done, where Flederman had lots of other business interests and was busy a lot and couldn't necessarily afford to always come in and just do pro bono work for the libraries, who were, like a typical library system, perpetually cash strapped. So, we'll leave Flederman out of the rest of the story because he really wasn't involved, aside from doing an appraisal of the collection in 1974, which was the basis for some of the values that would be used in the rest of the story. So anyway, now, recognizing that R.L. Wilson is very familiar with the State Library collection, which is like the best collection of Colts. They've got all sorts of stuff in there. Imagine what the Colt Company and Factory had in its reference collection, all sorts of early prototype experimental sorts of guns. Fantastic collection. Wilson, of course, knows about this. Lots of collectors would love to get their hands on some of these guns, Wilson included. He was obviously a substantial collector himself, as well as a dealer and an appraiser and a broker and everything else. He had his fingers in all the pies. Now, several years prior to this story taking place, and the main event we're talking about here took place about 1980, R.L. Wilson, as in his role as broker to the firearms, to the rich and wealthy of firearms collectors, he is approached by a man named Solly, who has a tremendous amount of money from, oil, something outside of firearms. Solly wants to put together a really good gun collection, and he hires Wilson to be his agent. You go out there, get me good guns, and I'll pay you a commission on them. And this is a place where so often trouble begins, because it is extremely common, especially pre-internet days, but even still today, for brokers like this, consignment agents, to totally abuse their position and totally defraud their alleged clients. Well, their real clients, their clients they're allegedly working for. I have no direct proof of it, but I'm pretty darn sure that this is exactly what Wilson did with Solly, because over the course of about 5 years, Solly spent somewhere between $6 and $7 million acquiring a collection of really good American firearms that included a whole bunch of really good Colts. Nobody knows exactly what he had. Nobody seems to, there isn't an inventory list floating around out there. No one knows exactly how many guns he had, but we do know he spent between $6 and $7 million on them. And in the course of only 5 years, this is mid-1970s money, this is a ton of money. Guy was fantastically wealthy. Now, you may think, well, okay, so maybe he overpaid for stuff, but man, it gets even worse because he didn't even take possession of the guns. Wilson convinced him that his own house wasn't sufficiently secure to hold this very fine, very expensive collection, and they'd really be better off if Wilson kept them at Wilson's own house, which he did. So Wilson spent, well, Solly spent $6 to $7 million acquiring guns that he almost certainly was billed extravagantly for by Wilson. There's the idea is supposed to be Wilson finds a great Colt for $100,000, buys it, and Solly then reimburses him $100,000 and gives him, typical is somewhere between a 10 or maybe a 15% commission. So here's $100,000 for the gun, and then here's $10,000 for yourself. But what typically happens instead when these guys get corrupted and greedy, which so often seems to happen, is Wilson buys the gun for $100,000 and goes, I found you this great Colt for only $200,000. So I'd like my $200,000, please, and I'd also like my 10% commission, so another $20,000. And he ends up just basically shoveling money in from the wealthy guy who doesn't really know what the guns are worth, because remember, Wilson's also acting as appraiser. So he'll pay $100, he'll sell it to Sully for $200, and he'll tell him, by the way, you got a great deal on this because I'm officially appraising this for $300,000. So, man, you just made $100,000. This is like fractal fraud is the way this sort of thing typically works. At any rate, in, I think it was 1979, Sully dies, and his estate has to be, taken care of. Ultimately, the bank is a bank. I don't know all the exact details of the estate situation, but bank's put in charge of getting rid of the gun collection. This is a significant amount of value to try to liquidate. What did they do? Well, the first thing they do is they offer it to R.L. Wilson, who helpfully appraises it himself for $4 million. So right off the bat, somewhere between $2 and $3 million of value has gone poof and disappeared, probably into Wilson's pocket. What the bank doesn't know is that Wilson is putting together a little partnership of dealers to try and buy this collection themselves for their own appraised values. And they are concerned that if they don't buy it as a unit, the whole collection will go to auction. I think it was Christie's had expressed an interest in auctioning off the collection. And here's the problem. If this collection goes to auction, it's going to flood the market with presumably really good historic American firearms, and that by itself will drive the prices down a lot because people can only afford to buy so much of it at one time. And frankly, this is a very real effect we've seen recently. There were a couple of really huge Luger collections that all came on the market at about the same time, and it really drove down the price of very high-end Lugers. At any rate, that's the least of these dealers, this little secret partnership's concern. Their real concern is the guns were overpriced to begin with. If they go to auction, they're going to bring their actual true value, that then somewhat reduced by the amount of stuff coming on the market. And they're legitimately concerned that this is going to like put a serious crimp on the entire industry for a long time to come, because those sale prices will be in the public record. And that's what people will go and look for when they say, oh, well, what's, Colt 1860 version X? What's it actually worth? Ah, well, there was one in the Sully collection and it sold at Christie's for $10,000. Well, if a couple of dealers can get their hands on the entire collection as a unit, they can then, between themselves, control what everything sells for. They can say, all right, we're going to agree that we're going to sell this one for $100,000 and that one for $200,000, and this one, well, we're pretty sure we're going to make that one a $1 million gun. And in this time period and the way that the market worked at this point, if you had the right group of people making this sort of collaborative decision, it would pretty much stick, especially with R.L. Wilson involved in it. If you wanted one of these guns, these are the dealers that you're going to have to come to, and they can pretty much tell you what you're going to pay. It's not strictly fraudulent by itself, but it's certainly of questionable ethical value. At any rate, the bank thinks they're just dealing with Wilson. Wilson's actually dealing with this group of investors. They go through the guns and they come up with a list of here's which guns each of them want for themselves and for resale. And they end up with a big pile of guns that none of them are really particularly interested in. And the problem is this accounts for like $1 million worth of the overall assessed value of the collection. And Wilson obviously doesn't want to put up the money himself. I wonder why he might not want to put up the money for some of those guns that he was specifically purchasing. It's entirely possible that maybe those guns weren't actually nearly as valuable or as good as he had told Sully they were and as he told the bank that they were. Anyway, he finally finds himself a sucker by the name of Hutchison, who is interested in getting into the firearms business, and Wilson convinces him that, hey, we've got this batch of guns from this once-in-a-lifetime estate opportunity, and you can buy them all, but you have to buy them all as a package for, I don't remember the exact number, it was something like $1.4 million. And what he says is like, and you'll make money back. Like, you can immediately turn around, sell these things for a nice profit, and make something like $400,000 on the deal. Hutchison thinks this is a great plan, trusts Wilson with it, borrows the money from his dad, who's tentatively okay with this, I suppose, turns around, buys all the guns. This, or agrees to, this gives Wilson, basically, he has now accounted for all of the Sully collection. He can turn around to the bank and actually buy the thing outright. And this little group of investors, Hutchison, by the way, kept separate from the rest of them. They don't know about this guy. They end up buying the thing for $3.2 million from the bank as a complete collection, which the bank is apparently pretty happy with because they just want to clear this out and be done with it. They don't have any real money of it and of their own invested in it. So net end result, Sully spent $6 to $7 million on the guns. They get sold to this conglomerate of dealers for $3.2 million. So half the value of the guns went poof along the way. And once the trade happens, this, by the way, is all legal. There are some questionable ethical practices involved, but no laws have been broken here. And the other dealers in this group start selling guns. Well, shockingly, it turns out that these guns that Hutchison bought, he's having a hard time turning, and his dad wants his investment money back. But weird, no one wants to buy these guns. So Wilson comes up with a brilliant plan, which potentially he had in mind from the very moment that he tried to get Hutchison involved in this whole deal. And that plan is, I know the guys at the Connecticut State Library. They don't know bupkis about guns. They really don't. The chief conservator librarian, the guy who was in charge of the guns, he just totally trusted Wilson. He knew effectively nothing about guns. And Wilson goes to him and says, hey, I've got this once-in-a-lifetime fantastic opportunity with this estate that we've got some guns that, like, fantastic, rare examples that really ought to be in this collection with the state of Connecticut. And the guy who has them is willing to trade them for just your duplicates, you know, your leftover stuff. You've got like 1,250 guns, something like 900 of them aren't on display anyway. And you know, they're duplicates. You can trust me, I'm your firearms expert. I also happen to be the guy brokering the deal for the guy getting rid of the guns. Also, I can appraise the value of all the guns, both coming in and going out. So, hey, it's a great one-stop shop. I can do this whole deal for you. What could possibly go wrong? Remember, when Colt gave these guns to the library, they did so with a very strict understanding, a very strict written contract agreement that the guns would not be sold and they would only be traded if they were exact duplicates. Well, Wilson comes in and starts sorting through the guns and has a very loose, one might say, fake, fraudulent, wrong, self-serving definition of duplicate. And it's much more along the lines of like, you have an 1860 Army, so you don't need this pre-production, unserialized, experimental 1860 Army. It's just a duplicate. We'll put it on the pile here that can get traded out. And ultimately, this winds up with the Connecticut State Library trading 290 of its guns out the door in exchange for receiving 8 guns and Sam Colt's cane. And if this sounds like a tremendously one-sided arrangement, it is. It is a totally one-sided arrangement. Now, they cover it up. Wilson covers it up by conveniently being able to appraise both sides of the deal. And he comes up with a value of basically $1.15 million on going in and coming out. There's a difference like $50,000 between the two halves of the deal. And conveniently, the library is getting the $50,000 better side of the deal. And so the trade goes through in 1980. And almost immediately, some of the guns that the Colt, that the museum, the library system has traded out, they start showing up on the market for sale. A lot of them apparently were privately brokered through Wilson, who almost certainly had buyers waiting for these guns before the trade was even finished. He knew everybody. He knew who was looking for what. He had lots of contacts. This is worldwide. This isn't just guns being sold in the U.S. This is them going overseas to everywhere. And frankly, some of these were probably purchased in good faith. Some of them were certainly purchased by people who knew that they were coming out of the Connecticut State Library collection. But hey, legitimately, those people had every reason to assume that this deal was on the up and up. I think I'm pretty comfortable putting most of the blame for this whole event on R.L. Wilson, from what I've read of the event. Now, the whole thing even gets worse. It's not just the library's only got 8 guns in. It's that 2 of those guns ended up being guns that had been stolen from Colt before they donated their collection to the Connecticut State Library. So those are actually guns that the library should have owned and would have owned without paying anything for them had they not been stolen by somebody else. And Wilson and probably Hutchison knew that those 2 guns were stolen. And to my mind, it's no surprise that those end up in this little pile of, okay, what can we pawn up, what can I get rid of to give to the library that I'm going to have a hard time selling any other way? 2 of them are a pair of guns known as the Von Siekel Dragoons that it would turn out in later years are generally accepted to be fakes. They were supposed to be highly engraved, originally Colt engraved examples of early Dragoons. Like, if these guns were real, they would be worth a tremendous amount of money. But, oops, they're probably not real. Sorry about that. I'm being texted. So, of our 8 guns, 4 of them right now are either fakes, probably fakes. I can't say 100% fakes. They are generally accepted to be fakes. They're definitely not what they were totally represented to be. Or guns that were stolen from the people who are now getting them back, effectively. It's really a disgusting, totally immoral, and legitimately fraudulent trade. Remember that in doing this, the library system was never supposed to be able to do this in the first place, because these guns that they traded out were absolutely not duplicates of anything. One of them was a pre-Patterson gun, a Colt Pearson. Pearson being basically the private gunsmith that Colt worked with before he could even establish a company. They're the very first handmade versions of Colt's theoretical patent revolver. And there was every one of them is handmade. They can't conceivably be duplicates, and yet one of them walks out the door to Hutchison. It should be pointed out that this is, Hutchison spent, $1.4 million on his chunk of the Solly collection. He then turned around and took 8 of those guns, and to be fair, we don't know how many he bought for $1.4 million, but he took 8 of them and had them assessed at a value of $1.1 million when he gave them to the library. And so this allowed him to basically launder a huge amount of value that he probably got screwed with by Wilson. So Wilson was first involved in almost certainly screwing Sully, then the entire collecting public in the disposition of the Sully collection, and then in pawning presumably the detritus of the Sully collection, including all the stuff that all the other dealers probably knew. That's the second time, it won't happen again, I apologize. All the detritus, all the stuff that the other collectors in this little confederation probably knew was a little bit sketchy or massively overvalued, Wilson manages to pawn that off on Hutchison, who pays cash money for it. And then, to get himself out of having to deal with Hutchison, he screws over the state of Connecticut and all of its residents, in getting those guns traded into the library system in exchange for legitimately really good stuff. There's a list, in fact, I can post part of it here while I'm talking, of the 290 guns that came out of the Connecticut Museum collection in this deal. And they include prototype Root rifles, cutaways, prototype 1860 armies, that one Colt Pearson, a huge, and a lot of stuff that doesn't look necessarily all that valuable, but it's hard to say. When the state police investigate this matter, they're a little bit hamstrung in trying to do a proper assessment of the value of what the museum lost, because they don't have the guns available to actually look at. Unfortunately, the state police would not investigate this issue until about 5 or 6 years later, in 1985 or so. They were tipped off by a collector who was familiar with the Connecticut Museum and said, you know, I'm really concerned because the guns that used to be on display aren't there. And some of the guns that are on display now are like really lesser versions of the things that used to be. This guy was concerned that someone was actually physically stealing guns and replacing them with fraudulent fakes, and tipped off the police. What the police discovered when they showed up is actually What was really going on was the library was trading good stuff out the door on the advice of R.L. Wilson. And this wouldn't be his only trade. It was by far the biggest one, but there were about half a dozen others in total. So ultimately, there would be no charges filed against R.L. Wilson for this particular incident, despite the Connecticut State Police coming to the pretty darn definitive conclusion that he did done wrong. The statute of limitations had expired by the time this case was in a position that it could have been taken to court, and so no charges were filed. However, Wilson would end up in jail later on other charges because it appears that this was not a one-time thing, shockingly. This was a habitual activity of the man, and it brings into question, I brought this up earlier, it brings into question basically all of his published literature, because we can't really be sure that some of the stuff that is described in these books wasn't fake and described in these books specifically for the purpose of getting them to sell for more money when he had a hand in their values and their brokeraging. Anyway, like I said at the beginning, if this sounded interesting, I have barely even touched the surface of all the innuendo and details and all the little sidebars that went along with this. Where you can find a lot more of that information is the podcast that Othias at CN Arsenal did with Danny Michaels from the Cody Firearms Museum. As I said at the beginning, if you're not a Patreon supporter of CN Arsenal, I would highly encourage you to do so. Check out their podcast, 2 hours long, going into all the details of this. Danny is quite familiar with the case because he's actually touched it in a couple of different ways at a couple of different museums that he's worked at. So his is a fascinating take on it. And then, of course, we also have, courtesy of the museum, we have the entire Connecticut State criminal investigation report on the incident, which is over at Forgotten Weapons, which you can download and read through for yourself. I think it would make this is the perfect making of a multi-part true crime podcast story. It's fascinating as it is depressing. And I think the biggest takeaway is, if you don't know what you have, get more than one opinion. And if there's someone who's coming in and offering you a deal, suggesting that they can act as seller's broker, buyer's broker, and appraiser, and take a cut of the winnings themselves, they might not be entirely above board. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this. It's unfortunate that the story came to pass, but man, it is a fantastic, fascinating story, and I hope it gives everybody some food for thought. So, thanks for watching. I'll catch you next time.